Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Interesting, mate. Yeah.
Welcome, listeners, to another episode of The Extra Inch. My name is Windy, and I'm joined by my sidekick and best friend, Bardi. Hello, Bardi.
Hello, Windy.
And our tactics guy, Nathan A. Clark. Hello, Nathan.
Hey, hey.
How you doing, boys?
Yeah, I'm not too bad, thank you. Not too bad.
Good. I think what we're going to do is talk a little bit about the Liverpool game, a little bit about the Crystal Palace game, and then finish off with some thoughts on the stadium. Because obviously in this week we've experienced the stadium in a Premier League match for the first time, and we were all there. So let's start off with Liverpool. We lost this game 2-1. I feel rather unfortunately. I thought my broad feelings about this game were that we played really well and that Poch, for the first time, outthought Jurgen Klopp. And I thought potentially we had the beating of them, but I thought we definitely deserved a draw. Bardi, let's start with you. What were your overall thoughts on this game, and did anything stand out to you?
Yeah, I mean, I was concerned after the first 15, 20 minutes, but there were still moments where I thought, even in that first half where we were under pressure and they were really exposing us down the wings, I thought we had enough kind of quality in us to still get something from the game. And I think perhaps Pochettino being up in the stands kind of worked to our benefit for once. But it's one of those games against a top team where it does kind of come down to those moments. And I just think in those key decision-making moments, they had the players who were a bit smarter and a little bit cleverer. And that's kind of what made us pay, I think, in the end.
So you're not blaming Hugo for the defeat?
Well, I did say our players should have been a bit smarter and a bit cleverer. But Hugo is obviously at fault, and it was his error that led to the winning goal. But I thought the team played well. I'm being overly positive here. I thought we played well. We deserved a point. And there's, you know, they're unbeaten at home for a long time, and we gave it a good old go, and it just didn't quite happen. And as always, it's the failings in our team, which it's almost like a repetition. You could repeat, just play an extra inch from before Christmas, and we'd be saying the same faults: midfield, goalkeeper, fullbacks. But I think by using Rose and Vertonghen at one point in the second half, we kind of made those weaknesses a bit of a strength, and we were a little bit unlucky.
So let's build on that and talk about some of the tactical exchanges between the two teams. Nathan, we started off with a back three or back five, depending on how you look at it. We got exposed with the first Liverpool goal, where Robertson had the ball out wide and Trippier didn't know whether to go out to meet him or to hang back and cover the run of Mane. And I think Poch did a really good job of identifying that was a big problem and fixing it. So talk us through what he did and whether you think it worked.
So he moved to this sort of wonky formation that we have seen a couple of times before, and we also saw against Palace, where it's very difficult to describe. It's sort of a back three, it's sort of a back four. It's like there's like a defensive fullback and a wing back on one side, and then there's just a standard fullback on the opposite side. So Trippier is sort of playing a bit of a back and forth role. Vertonghen is sitting as a defensive left back, and Rose is pelting up and down the wing. I think there's effectiveness in its unusualness, in that teams aren't really sure how to shape up against a team that are sort of between formations. And the asymmetry sort of opens up options as well. One of the things it meant is that Sissoko received the ball in the half turn a lot, and that was really effective. Where Sissoko, as we've said many times, struggles is in receiving the ball. But once he's on the ball, his ability to carry it is quite impressive, and it certainly was in this game.
Yeah, I think that's a very fair point. And essentially what we're saying is Pochettino got the best out of our players through a formation change, but also importantly nullified the threat from Liverpool. And that was very important because, like Bardi said, they did have some strong moments in the first half. I slightly disagree that they were strong for the first 15 minutes. I thought actually we kept them pretty quiet for the first 10, and it was only then that they started to impose their style upon us. And Robertson kept getting the ball at that point on the left. And, you know, even after they'd scored the opener, there was another opportunity where a similar cross came in, and we nearly had the same problem all over again. But then Poch did react, and that's often been a criticism of him, that he doesn't react until it's too late. This time he was really proactive. And Bardi's mentioned there that he thinks it may have been due to the fact that he was watching from the stands. Do you buy into that, Nathan?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I said before when he got the touchline ban that there's sort of... That's perhaps not the worst punishment to have. Having the key tactical mind at the club have a view where he can more easily see the shape and space and everything, you know, how could that not possibly be a positive?
I totally agree. Sorry.
Yeah, I also think the positioning of Kane was very interested in this game because we never put Kane up against Van Dijk. So we kind of almost nullified, in a weird kind of way, we nullified their best defender, that he had no direct opponent. So by Kane dropping deep in between the Liverpool's midfield, which, as we know, isn't the most disciplined of midfield, and Van Dijk and Matip unwilling to kind of step into that territory, it did create a lot of space for Kane. And you could clearly see we were trying to use the speed of Lucas in the first half and then Son when he came on the counter, or trying to turn them quickly. So I thought Kane, he almost sacrificed his danger, is like the dangerousness that he possesses around the goal area by dropping deep, and he helped create the equalising goal by dropping deep, winning a foul, and spreading the play.
Kane's passing was used to great effect in this game, and he always, in my opinion, has been an excellent passer, but it hasn't always been highlighted, and that's partly due to the fact that he's often played as a nine, whereas now he's more willing to come deep and take responsibility, or for the last 2 years, really. But he used the ball fantastically. And like you say, I thought Lucas had a really, really good game, actually. I thought that was his best performance he's put in a Spurs shirt. The thing that changed for me with Lucas in this match was his first touch was really neat. Often I find that it's a bit unpredictable. Sometimes it bounces off him and he can't hold the ball up. This time, I felt he was really strong with his back to goal, and he was often holding the ball up and then, you know, using other players to allow him to turn and then run at the Liverpool defence. And that was incredibly useful. What did you make of Lucas's performance, Nathan?
I was nowhere near as positive
as
you.
Okay.
I think I'm going to go back and watch this game at some point because for tactically to sort of look at the granular details, and maybe I'll keep an eye out for re-examining how I thought Lucas played in this game. But I mean, generally, I'm not Lucas's biggest fan.
No, I'm not either, and I still think long term. We'll just take any offer. You know, we'll take, if an offer comes in of over 20 million, we'll take it. I honestly think that. I don't think he's going to be a Spurs player for a long time. But I thought he did have his use in this game, and I kind of appreciated his performance for the first time in quite some time.
Like to say that I have zero problem with Lucas. I think his goals to game ratio isn't too bad. He scores goals. He offers us a threat. He can play multiple roles. His injury record is fine. And there are other forward players who are less reliable who I would happily get rid of first.
Side eye at Lamella there.
It's unfortunately, in a period where we've had an increasing amount of injuries and stresses in other areas of the team, when you're looking for your squad to be there and be available, he continues to not be available. And this is nothing to do with Lamella as a player, as a person or anything like that, but physically he's unable to be a reliable option, and as a squad player you know, you basically want them to be available when others aren't, and he never is.
Yeah, I find it very difficult to argue with that point. It's spot on, really. I really like Lamela as a player, but we can't just carry someone who's just constantly injured.
No.
Ultimately. We're going to have to talk about Lloris, I think. But before we do, let's just quickly talk about our missed chances. So firstly, the Eriksen chance, which has been oft overlooked in post-game analysis. Now, I think an in-form Eriksen probably takes a touch here and then probably buries the chance. Bardi, what did you make of Eriksen's missed opportunity?
I think it's a difficult one to blame him. I think had he taken a touch, he probably might have won a penalty. Robertson had definitely committed to the block and he might have been able to win a clever penalty and maybe get Robertson sent off. And then maybe he could have chipped it or done something differently. But I think it's unfair to blame him for that. He was running onto that at speed. Robertson was coming at speed. So I don't think you can blame him really for that opportunity.
Fair enough. And I'm kind of using that as an in to launch an Eriksen conversation when we talk about the Crystal Palace game. But before we do that, Sissoko's chance was the next big one. So a lot's been made of Virgil van Dijk's defending on this opportunity, and I think there's two or three factors here. So firstly, there's the fact that Van Dijk has essentially allowed Sissoko to take the shot, which you could argue is good defending. He sort of knew that Son was more dangerous in front of goal and Sissoko had less chance of scoring, so he made that judgment call in his head. The other factor to take into account, though, I think Sissoko's touches weren't great. He probably should have carried the ball slightly wider. And also, I think Son's run wasn't the best either, and that kind of helped Van Dijk a little. Ultimately, Sissoko's shot was awful, and he should have done better. Like, I think he probably should have tried to pass it into the corner, and he would have scored rather than trying to go for power. But Nathan, what did you make of that opportunity? Was there anything that you think could have gone differently there?
I think you make a good point with Son's run. I think he could have gone wider. I think he could have slowed, changed, or increased his speed, or generally done more. I understand that. In the majority of cases, he just makes the direct run and it's not Sissoko and he gets found or the other player is able to work the opportunity for himself. But in those circumstances, Son probably could have done more. And I think that's probably the most undiscussed facet of this piece of play. So I think that you make a good point there. But yeah, I think Van Dijk is rightfully getting highly praised for this because he maintains pressure on the passing option and he maintains enough pressure on the shot option that he's essentially able to foil both at the same time, and that is incredibly good defending.
Mm. He is magnificent. It's actually, I found that watching that whole chance back, I did find it really interesting from a number of, not just because it's almost cathartic in some ways, like just watching it over and over again, thinking, what was he doing? But it's a fascinating insight into the psychology of being a defender against, you know, Son having to make that split second decision. How do I handle a situation? Like you say, if Kane's got the ball there or if Dele's got the ball there and charging forward, he probably would have done exactly the same thing and been found. But he needs to remember that Sissoko's not got that kind of poise and vision in the final third and won't behave in the same way. I found it interesting. But let's talk about Hugo Lloris. Nathan, I've seen some of your tweets on this and I found the takes very interesting. So do you want to explain where you are with Lloris at the moment?
Essentially what I tweeted is that you can acknowledge the issues that he's having, the mistakes he's making, the fact that he's generally probably dropped off over the last sort of 3-4 years, and that he does have these sort of semi-regular occurrences of mistakes in big games. And if you look at that play, it's a very frustrating experience for Spurs fans. But he's still probably a net positive on an average to good Premier League keeper. I think we forget his general shot-stopping ability and how that compares to just an average keeper. He's not a bad player. Again, he is frustrating to experience because we're aware of this drop-off and we're aware of the way he can cost us in big games, and that's when it hurts the most. But I still think that he's still pretty good.
So you currently are happy to stick with Lloris for next season?
Apart from anything else, as we've mentioned many times, we have bigger priorities. I think if our squad was in a better place, you know, we can maybe look at the goalkeeper, but I think he's sort of fourth or fifth priority at the moment, and that's not something that you want to be getting done in a single summer.
And Bardi, how about you? Are you thinking along similar lines?
I said a while ago that I've been unhappy with Lloris. I think it was on the Extra Inch. We were talking about areas to improve, and I've been concerned about him and his drop off. He still makes, as Nathan says, he makes good saves and point winning saves, but he is making fundamental errors now, which is costing us games, sending offs, rash decisions, and when a goalkeeper starts just mishandling the football. This isn't a sweeping error or a technical footballing error. This is a fundamental flaw where he's unable to catch a pretty soft header as he hits the ground. For me, that's a sign that he's probably dead as a top-class goalkeeper. But I don't think we're able to go out and buy a Hugo Lloris. Like when we went out and bought the French number one captain, I don't think we're able to do that now. We'd either have to take a gamble on a young goalkeeper and then allow him the opportunities to make these mistakes in first team football, which is a very dangerous place to be. So personally, I don't think we'll replace him. I think we'll give him another go, and then hopefully our scouts find someone young who we can give proper rotation to in the cups and stop wasting our time with Vorm and Gazzaniga. Find a proper real understudy who can then grow into becoming our number one, because we're not going to sign an Oblak or go out and buy Lafont from Fiorentina. That kind of stuff's not going to happen.
Really interesting to get your thoughts. I'm sort of agreeing with both of you, I think, there. In that, I don't have faith in him anymore. And I therefore, if I don't have faith in him, I'm sort of thinking perhaps the defence don't. But, like Nathan says, there are bigger fish to fry in our squad. We have to fix the central midfield issue. We have to fix the fullback issue. And so Lloris's the issue of fixing the goalkeeper is down the priority list.
Yeah. Do you know what would be excellent is to have a 18, 19-year-old academy product who could play. But I don't think, from what you've spoken about, I don't think we've got anything. I mean, I can't remember the last academy product goalkeeper we created. Maybe who's the Scottish guy? Archer, Button, Ian Walker.
I mean, the thing is, Archer and Button are both playing at a good level, but they're not Premier League goalkeepers, and they're certainly not top four goalkeeper. Actually, Button's actually at Southampton now, I think, so he technically is a Premier League goalkeeper. But he's not playing regularly for a Premier League team.
Ian Walker, was he the last goalkeeper we produced?
God.
The other one we kind of trained up from a teenager, now works in the financial industry.
Who was that?
Espen Bardsen.
Oh, yeah.
Quit football. So now a banker.
So we have got some reasonable young goalkeepers. We've got Brandon Austin and Jonathan Deby, who both look good, but until they've been out on loan and had opportunities to play, we just don't know. It's so different. The mentality of goalkeeping at various levels is so different, and we need to test them to know how good they are.
And the price of goalkeepers now is ridiculous. Oh, yeah, Jordan Pickford, 30 million, Alisson, 80 million. They are like strikers now. They're that expensive.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
So let's move on to talk a little bit about a win. Before the Palace game, we were on our worst run for 7 years, which I find sort of quite staggering, to be honest. It felt bad, but not that bad. But we came through this match unscathed, and we actually put in a fairly, on the whole, fairly controlled performance. Again, there were some interesting tactical decisions made by Pochettino. So he played Danny Rose on the left of what was sort of 4-2-3-1-ish. And actually, I had a really good interaction on Twitter where I had my mind changed on a point, which was is quite a rare and nice thing. So I tweeted post-match that I thought Rose was really, really bad. And that was based on the fact that he just constantly gave the ball away. So for context, Rose played 66 minutes, something like that, and he lost possession 32 times, which is staggeringly high and pretty much double anyone else in the team on the day. But Greg Jenner, amongst other people, said, but the thing Rose did was he pushed Aaron Wan-Bissaka back, and he caused his presence and his thrust and his front-footedness caused Crystal Palace to be more reserved on that side. And I think that's a good point. And I hadn't thought of it in that way. And yeah, it totally changed my view. Nathan, what did you make of the team shape in general? And did you feel like it worked against Palace's narrow 4-3-3?
So I had it down more as the sort of the wonky shape we were discussing earlier against Liverpool is sort of, yeah, between a 4-2-3-1 and a 3-4-3, where Rose played this left wing back slash winger role, and Trippier got up and down on the right a little bit, more like a classic fullback. And then Eriksen and Son sort of playing quite inside, but neither is the number 10. So yeah, I agree with essentially Greg's take there, in that Rose wasn't hugely productive and he did lose the ball a lot, but he gave us that width on that side, which opened up the middle for us to play through there.
I thought Ben Davis had a really solid game as well, and that role, that sort of slightly more reserved role, suited him really nicely, and it's made me think a little bit more about whether Davis should stay and remain a squad player, because he does have the ability to play on the left side of a back three as well as at left back. And I think Davis is not a spectacular player by any stretch, but he's pretty much a solid defender, and he's quite switched on defensively, and I appreciated his performance in this match.
Yeah, I also quite liked the combination between Rose and Davies. It was very kind of old school 4-4-2, left wing kind of dovetailing between the two of them. It also kept Wan-Bissaka quiet, who is... I've not been a huge admirer of his, but I saw him play live for the first time and I thought he was excellent. And I thought that also kept him very quiet and stopped him from rampaging down the wing if Hodgson had kind of ordered that. Yeah, and I was quite happy with Rose. He was a bit loose in the challenge every now. He was a bit loose with his touch every now and then, but he gives a fully committed performance each time he plays. He goes in for tackles. He tries to get involved as much as he can. He did have that kind of one glorious opportunity in the first half where I don't know whether Spurs had it written into all their contracts that Kane had to score the first goal. But instead of shooting, he tried to pass it inexplicably. But I thought his game was fine.
How about you, Nathan?
Davies is sort of the archetypal second choice left back, sort of a safe defensive option. Can sort of play centre back as well. He can play centre back as well, but you wouldn't want him to be starting there regularly. And yeah, I think essentially he played the role of a defensive fullback, and that played into his hands a lot because he has a lot less ground to cover. I think that he can operate quite well in the final third in terms of his sort of fairly creative passing. That where he struggles is getting back and forth the whole match, and when Rose is essentially doing his attacking job for him, he can do a really good job in a much smaller area. I did feel that between them, there were a couple of times where they weren't sure who should be picking up sort of a second ball, because they're both, you know, mentally they're both left back, so they sort of got, there was a little bit of confusion between them, but on the whole, the shape really worked. On the Kane getting the first goal thing, I did think there was a bit of that, but I also thought there was a bit of everyone wanted the first goal for themselves too. So it was either I'm going to score or I'm going to set Harry Kane up, but I'm definitely not going to set up Dele. I'm definitely not going to set up Eriksen. I'm definitely not going to set up Son. And I think there was we had a sort of a bit of a problem with that until the first goal, at least.
So the other key players on the day, I personally thought Dele had a really solid game in midfield again. I've been very impressed with him in that deeper role, as I always am when he plays there. Sissoko notably had a strong performance, and Nathan, you were very big on his outing.
Yeah, again, he carried the ball really well. We were able to get to him on the half turn so that he wasn't receiving under pressure much. He carried it quite some distance repeatedly, and he also won the ball a lot, which essentially that's all you want. That's what we want. That's what Pochettino wants from his central midfielder, a ball winner who can carry the ball forward. And he fulfilled that well. You know, as well as you could expect him to.
And the player that I thought was underrated in this match was Christian Eriksen, who has had a considerable rough patch, to say the least. I mean, you can put that down to fatigue, confidence, perhaps already thinking of his future after the end of the season. But I thought he kind of showed signs of coming back to something like his best form in this match. Bardi, what did you make of Eriksen's performance here?
I've been highly critical of Eriksen, and I think he's almost, sometimes he underplays what he's doing, and other times he's trying to overplay, he's trying to be too clever. He's definitely bereft of confidence, because there was a few opportunities in the first half where the ball was looped over to him. He had his back to goal, and had he been feeling a bit more confident, I think he would have taken the ball, controlled it, and then tucked it away quickly within one or two touches, where instead he kind of doubted himself. Second half, he was definitely better. He got his goal. He set up Son. So even though he's not actually playing well, he's still statistically getting his assists and creating things for the team. He's miles off where he can be as a player, but he's doing okay. I mean, we don't have anyone else to put in there in that position, so it's not like I reckon we should drop him. But hopefully now he'll start to find a bit of rhythm, because we desperately need him. He's the player that makes us really tick. On Dele, I liked him deeper. I think he was quite assured, but I still think the brilliant thing about Dele is it's his one-touch passing. It's his kind of linking in other players. And the closer he physically is to the opposition goal, the more effective he is, the more dangerous he is. Dele facing the goal in his own half with the ball, it's fine. But I don't think he has the range of passing. And he doesn't like switching onto his left foot and spreading the play that way either. So I think deeper, we kind of limit his effectiveness. But we had no other option. And I think once Winks came on, we actually saw what it's like to have a proper central midfielder there. And I think through all of this, for me, Winks has been like one of our most improved players this season. He stepped onto the pitch and all of a sudden we had a proper central midfield presence there, which is, he is a better kind of holding central midfielder than Dele ever will be.
Yeah, I think I pretty much agree with that. I think Dele is such a good player that he could probably play anywhere, but he's at his best when he's in the final third, as you say, and that's where we need him to be. Eriksen, I definitely feel, is on the steps back in the right direction. He came away with five chances created. He had six shots, only got two on target. So there's, like you say, there are issues with confidence there. But I think hopefully, you know, having created one from winning the ball back and feeding Son, and then scoring one by sort of latching onto that Kane opportunity, he hopefully will, that will stand him in good stead, and he might start feeling a little better. We really need him to perform in these last few weeks if we're going to finish top four, because like you say, he's so vital. And Nathan, any final thoughts on the Palace game?
I'll get in on an Eriksen a bit there. I think that his run of form has been dramatically overplayed as to how bad it's been. I do think there's been a drop off, but as ever with Eriksen, I think there are tactical reasons. I think it's no wonder that we're talking about him having a good game after we've just praised our central midfielders. And again, there's such a huge relationship there, is that Eriksen thrives when he can sort of receive a gentle pass in dangerous areas. And that's what he got. And if he was an even better player than he was, he would find a way to utilize his attacking ability in circumstances that don't favor him. So you can, there is a legitimate criticism there. But a player like that is incredibly rare. I think if you look at Eriksen's sort of contemporaries, which is Ozil and David Silva, they're really not dissimilar. Isco, again, it's the same kind of stuff where they all want the right circumstances, and when they have those circumstances, they can make things happen. So, and I think that's what we saw a little more of against Palace.
Yeah, I think that's a very, very fair point. And for that reason, I think if Eriksen were to move, I think he would look an absolute star in a team with an outstanding central midfield behind him. And he's just going to go to the next level. Let's talk a bit about the stadium then. So this was our first experience of being in the stadium for a Premier League game. We'd all been there previously. So Bardi went to the Legends match. Nathan and I both went to the under-18 match. Bardi, let's go with you. How did you find the stadium? What were your overall thoughts?
Overall, I was positive about it. I've endured Wembley for a good season and a half, and I've enjoyed moments of the football, but I haven't enjoyed the experience of going to the game and everything else that surrounds Wembley. So immediately for me, I was already on a positive going back to White Hart Lane. For me, Wembley's half an hour door to door, so you know it makes my life more difficult to get to White Hart Lane, but I go to the football to watch Tottenham, and I want to watch Tottenham at home. I think the stadium is beautiful. I like the sound that echoes around it. I really enjoy my seat. I think there's a lot of positive things to be taken from it. There are one or two teething issues where people have kind of been displaced and everything else like that, which affected the atmosphere. But I also think I've seen some comments, people complaining about how it felt. But I think that game was so stressful. We'd been on such a bad run. We were so desperate not to lose. And the narrative that would have come along had we lost that game. So I think the stress and everything else played a part in the atmosphere. And I think against City on Tuesday, I think we'll see a much different stadium and a much more relaxed and positive feel to it. There's definitely teething issues with transport, with the bars and everything else. But overall, I have to say it was a positive experience and I can't wait to go back.
That's excellent. How about you, Nathan? How did you find it?
I did have some trouble with the transport. I think that the infrastructure just it doesn't hold up at the moment. And I don't know what they might be able to do if they can sort of dramatically extends the overground station in White Hart Lane, especially now that they've renamed it. So I sprained my ankle a couple of weeks back. So I was hobbling around on a cane. Like it's not bad, and like obviously I chose to buy a ticket, so I knew the risks I was getting myself into. But I back at the old White Hart Lane, I used to get the train to Seven Sisters and changed on the overground from Seven Sisters to White Hart Lane, and that wasn't an option for me because there was no sort of there was no real stewarding at Seven Sisters, so there was just a sort of a push and a shove and a queue of 100 people for each set of doors to get on the overground train, and that wasn't an option for me, which meant I hobbled the sort of, I don't know, what is it, a mile between Seven Sisters and the stadium on my dodgy ankle, which wasn't great. But again, like I knew what I was getting into, so I'm not too upset about that. I think more long term, I went with my dad, who's now in his 60s and he's got dodgy knees. And I'm a little worried for him making that journey on the regular. And also his season ticket, the only season ticket that was available and he could afford, is in Park Lane. So he's standing the full match. And again, you know, he knew what he was getting into when he got that. He knew it was going to be a standing ticket. It's just a little bit of a worry in that regard. I still managed to arrive in time to catch the opening ceremony. Here's the thing with that. I cried. And yet at the same time, I also thought it was kind of naff. I think that I would have cried if there was no opening ceremony and all that happened was that there was 60,000 Spurs fans in the stadium singing the team in. I think it was more about the occasion and the way that the club handled it. And I would like, I think the atmosphere may have been better if instead of the opening ceremony, we were just given room to sing, because, and this is the thing that isn't particular to this game, so I'm going off a bit of a rant now, where we have this, and maybe it's going to be different now, but we have this long intro where we blast various different musics and various different intros and little talks about the team sort of for 15-20 minutes before the teams come out. and it gives us no room to get an atmosphere going before kickoff. And there were these few breaks in between segments, in between singing, where the Spurs fans tried to get a song going, and then the music. By the way, those speakers are incredibly high quality as sort of the resident sound tech. I've got to come in at how good the sound tech is in the stadium. But yeah, I was a little disappointed with that.
Yeah, I'd like to agree totally with what Nathan said there. I think the showing of adverts of Lucas cooking a pad thai or whatever it was kind of totally drowned out any natural atmosphere building. I think the music on the PA system should just be turned off because it's unnecessary. But I think they were showing a lot of the kind of community development and outreach programs that they had been doing. So hopefully that was just a one-off. But yeah, the sound system is insane. It's too loud. Someone needs to pull the plug on it because it doesn't allow any. They want organic support, then turn the music off.
Nice. Well, it sounds like you both had a good time. I had a slightly different experience, but that's partly through my own doing. So I'm not going to talk about it.
Don't drive to Tottenham.
The stadium looks absolutely beautiful. That's, you know...
It really does.
So the key things, I think, are the stadium looks beautiful. It's still in Tottenham. And people will eventually, you know, make their connections and get used to the acoustics. And it will be absolutely brilliant going forward. Like Barty said, there are some slight teething problems which they need to address. They've got the rest of the season to address that. And then I think next season it's just going to be awesome. And, you know, it's going to be a great destination. Let's leave it there, chaps. It's been good chatting to you. Let's do it again soon. Hopefully after another win. It's the fight in. It's the fight in. Clock. It's the fight in.
It's the fight in. Clock. Oh, that was really interesting, mate, yeah.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's stamps.com. Code program.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There are stories and mythology that this country has woven around black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders. And we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like, worry of police.
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.